Imagination? Of course, but why? Because he had learned about Tigraine? Imagination or madness?
Someone has come I think you should see, Bashir said at his elbow, and Rand jerked away from the women overhead.
Had he really been glaring back at them?
Bashir had one of his horsemen with him, a taller fellow, not hard to be, beside Bashir, with a dark beard and mustaches, his tilted eyes green.
Not unless it's Elaine, Rand said, more harshly than he meant, or somebody with proof the Dark One is dead. I'm going to Cairhien this morning.
He had had no such intention until the words left his mouth. Egwene was there, and the queens overhead were not.
It's been weeks since I was there last. If I don't keep an eye on them, some lord or lady will claim the sun throne behind my back.
Bashir looked at him strangely. He was explaining too much.
As you say, but you will want to see this man first. He says he comes from Lord Brend, and I think he speaks truth.
The Aiel were on their feet in the instant. They knew who used that name. For Rand's part, he stared at Bashir in surprise. The last thing he expected was an emissary from Samael.
Bring him in.
Ahmad,
Bashir said with a jerk of his head, and the younger Saldaean trotted away. A few minutes later, Ahmad returned with a knot of Saldaeans, warily guarding a fellow in their midst. At first glance, nothing about the man accounted for their caution. With no weapon visible, he wore a long gray coat with a raised collar, and a curly beard but no mustache, both in the Ilianar fashion. He had a stub of a nose and a wide, grinning mouth. As he came closer, though, Rand realized that grin never altered by a hair. The man's whole face seemed frozen in that one mirthful expression. By contrast, his dark eyes stared out of that mask, swimming with fear. At 10 paces, Bashir raised his hand, and the guard halted. The Ilianar, staring at Rand, did not seem to notice until Ahmad presented a sword point to his chest, making him stop or be run through. He only glanced at the slightly serpentine blade, then returned to staring at Rand with those terrified eyes and that grinning face. His hands hung at his sides, twitching as much as his face was still. Rand started to close the distance, but abruptly Sulin and Urien were there, not exactly blocking his way, yet positioned so that he would have to push between them.
"I wonder what has been done to him," Sulin said, studying the fellow.
A number of maidens in red shields had come out from the columns, some even veiled.
"If he is not Shadow Spawn, he is touched by the Shadow."
"One like that might do things we cannot know," Urien said.
He was one of those with a scarlet strip of cloth around his temples.
"Kill with a touch, perhaps.
A pretty message that would be to send an enemy." Neither looked at Rand, not directly, but he nodded. Perhaps they were right.
"How are you called?" he asked.
Sulin and Urien moved a step to either side when they saw he would stay where he was.
"I do come from... from Samael," the man said woodenly, through that grin. "I do bring a message for the dragon reborn. For you."
Well, that was direct enough. Was he a dark friend or just some poor soul Samael had trapped in one of the nastier weavings Asmodian had talked about?
"What message?" Rand said.
The Ilianar's mouth worked, struggled. What came out bore no relation to the voice he had used before. It was deeper, full of confidence, in a different accent.
"We will stand on different sides, you and I, come the day of the great lord's return. But why should we kill each other now and leave Demondred and Grendel to contest for the world over our bones?"
Rand knew that voice, in one of those scraps from Luz Theron that had settled in his mind. Samael's voice. Luz Theron snarled wordlessly.
"Already you have much to digest," the Ilianar went on, or Samael did. Why bite off more? And hard chewing, even if you don't find Simarag or Asmodian taking you from behind while you are busy with it. I propose a truce between us, a truce until the day of return. If you do not move against me, I will not against you. I will pledge not to move east beyond the plains of Maredo, nor further north than Lugard in the east, or Johanna in the west. You see, I leave the greater share by far to you. I do not claim to speak for the rest of the Chosen, but at least you know you have nothing to fear from me, or out of the lands I hold. I will pledge not to aid them in anything they do against you, nor to help them defend against you. You have done well, so far, in removing the Chosen from the field. I have no doubt you will continue to do well, better than before, knowing your southern flank is safe, and the others fight without my aid. I suspect that on the day of return, there will be only you and I, as it should be, as it was meant to be.
The man's teeth clicked shut, hidden behind that frozen grin. His eyes looked near madness. Rand stared. A truce with Samael? Even if he could have trusted the man to keep it, even if it meant one danger set aside until all the others were dealt with, it also meant leaving countless thousands to Samael's mercy, a quality the man had never had. He felt rage sliding across the surface of the void and realized he had seized Sidene. That torrent of searing sweetness and freezing filth seemed to echo his anger. Lose Theron. Well enough that he should be mad in his madness. The echo resonated with his own fury till he could not tell one from the other.
"Take this message back to Samael," he said coldly. "Every death he has caused since waking, I lay at his feet and called you. Every murder he has ever done or caused, I lay at his feet and called you. He escaped justice in the Rorn Madai and at Nol Caimain and Sohadra."
More of Luz Theron's memories, but the pain of what had been done there, the agony of what Luz Theron's eyes had seen, burned across the void as if Rand's.
"But I will see justice done now. Tell him, no truce with the Forsaken. No truce with the Shadow."
The messenger lifted a spasming hand to wipe sweat from his face. No, not sweat. His hand came away red. Crimson droplets oozed from his pores, and he trembled head to foot. Hamad gasped and stepped back, and he was not the only one. Bashir knuckled his mustaches with a grimace, and even the Aiel stared. Painted red, the Ilianer collapsed in a convulsing heap, blood spreading around him in a dark, glistening pool smeared by his thrashing. Rand watched him die, buried deep in the void, feeling nothing. The void walled off emotion, and there was nothing he could have done in any case. Had he known healing, he did not think it would have stopped that.
"I think," Bashir said slowly, "maybe Samael will have his answer when this fellow does not return. I have heard of killing a messenger who brought bad news, but never killing him to tell you the news was bad."
Rand nodded. The death changed nothing. It changed no more than learning of Tigraine had. "Have someone see to his burial. A prayer will not hurt, even if it doesn't help either." Why did those queens in their colored windows still seem accusing? Surely they had seen as bad in their lifetimes, maybe even in this chamber. He could still point to Alana, feel her. The void was no shield. Could he trust Egwene? She kept secrets. "I may spend the night in Cairhien."
"A strange end to a strange man," Avienda said, stepping around the dais.
Small doors behind it led to the robing rooms, and from there to corridors beyond. Rand started to step between her and what lay on the red and white tiles, then stopped. After one curious glance, Avienda ignored the body.
When she was a maiden of the spear, she had surely seen as many men die as he ever had. By the time she gave up the spear, she had probably killed as many as he had then seen die. It was him she concentrated on, running her eyes over him, to make sure he had taken no hurt. Some of the maidens smiled at her, and they opened a path to Rand, pushing red shields aside where necessary. But she stayed where she was, readjusting her shawl and studying him. It was a good thing that, whatever the maidens thought, she only stayed near him because the wise ones told her to spy on him, because he found himself wanting to put his arms around her right there. Good that she did not want him. He had given her the ivory bracelet she wore, roses among thorns, suiting her nature. It was her only piece of jewelry except for a silver necklace, the intricate patterns the Kandori called snowflakes. He did not know who had given her that. Light, he thought disgustedly, wanting Avienda and Elaine when he knew he could have neither. You're worse than Matt ever thought of being. Even Matt had the sense to stay away from a woman if he thought he would harm her. I must go to Kyrian too, she said. Rand grimaced. One attraction of a night in Kyrian was that it would be a night without her in the same room. It has nothing to do with— she began sharply, then bit her full underlip, blue-green eyes flashing. I must speak with the wise ones, with Amis. Of course, he told her. No reason you shouldn't. There was always the chance he could manage to leave her behind there. Bashir touched his arm. You are going to watch my horsemen go through their paces again this afternoon. The tone was casual, yet his tilted eyes gave the words heavy weight. It was important, but Rand felt a need to be out of Camelin, out of Andor. Tomorrow, or the day after. He had to be away from the eyes of those queens, wondering whether one of their blood, light he was, would tear their land apart as he had so many others. Away from Alana. If only for a night, he had to be away. Chapter 17, The Wheel of a Life. Gathering his sword belt from beside the throne with a flow of air, and the scepter too, Rand opened the gateway right there before the dais, a slash of light that rotated, widening to give a view of an empty, dark-paneled chamber more than 600 miles from Camelin, in the Sun Palace, the royal palace of Kyrian. Set aside for his use this way, the room held no furnishings, but dark blue floor tiles and wood-paneled walls glistened from polishing. Windowless, the room was bright anyway. 8 gilded stand lamps burned day and night, mirrors magnifying the oil-fed lamps. He paused to buckle on his sword, while Sulin and Urien opened the door to the corridor and led veiled maidens in red shields through before him. In this case, he thought their caution ridiculous. The broad corridor outside, the only way to reach the room, was already crowded with 30 or so Far Aldazar Din, Brothers of the Eagle, and nearly 24 of Berlane's Mayenners, in red-painted breastplates and rimmed pot-like helmets that came down to the nape of the neck and back. If there was one place anywhere that Rand knew he needed no maidens, it was Kyrian. More so even than Tyr. A Brother of the Eagle was already loping down the hallway by the time Rand appeared, and a Mayenner awkwardly clutching spear and short sword as he followed the taller Aielman. In fact, a small army trailed after the Far Aldazar Din, servants in various liveries, a tyrant defender of the stone in burnished breastplate and black and gold coat, a Kyrian soldier with the front of his head shaved, his breastplate much more battered than the tyrant's, 2 young Aiel women in dark heavy skirts and loose white blouses, whom Rand thought he recognized as apprentices to wise ones. News of his arrival would spread quickly. It always did. At least Alana was far away. Varen, too, but most of all Alana. He still felt her, even at this distance, just a vague impression that she was somewhere to the west. Like the feel of a hand, just a hair from touching the back of his neck. Was there any way to get free of her?
He seized Saideen again for a moment, but that still made no difference.
"You never escape the traps you spin yourself."
Luz Theron's murmur sounded confused.
"Only a greater power can break a power, and then you're trapped again. Trapped forever, so you cannot die."
Rand shivered. Sometimes it really did seem that voice was speaking to him. If only it would make sense once in a while, having it in his head would be easier.
"I see you, Karakhan," one of the brothers of the Eagle said.
His gray eyes were on a level with Rand's, the scar slashing across his nose, stark white against his sun-dark face.
"I am Korman of the Mosada Goshin. May you find shade this day."
Rand had no chance to answer properly before the pink-cheeked Mayenner officer was shouldering in. Well, not exactly shouldering. He was too slender to shoulder aside a man a head taller and half again as wide, especially an Aiel, though maybe young enough to think he could. Yet he did squeeze himself in front of Rand next to Korman, tucking under his arm a crimson helmet with a single slender red plume.
"My Lord Dragon, I'm Javier Nurella, Lord Lieutenant in the Winged Guards."
There were wings worked on the sides of his helmet.
"In service to Berlain Sir Peandrag Peron, first of Mayen, and at your service also."
Korman gave him an amused, sideways look.
"I see you, Javier Nurella," Rand said gravely, and the boy blinked.
Boy? Come to think on it, he might be no younger than Rand. That was a shock.
"If you and Korman will show me..."
Suddenly he realized Avienda was gone. He nearly broke his back trying to avoid the woman, and the first time in weeks he agreed to let her near him, she slipped away as soon as his head turned.
"Take me to Berlain and Ruach," he ordered gruffly. "If they're not together, take me to whoever is closer and find the other."
Running to the Wise Ones, no doubt, to report on what he had been up to.
He would leave the woman behind here. "What you want is what you cannot have. What you cannot have is what you want."
Luz Theron laughed maniacally. It did not bother Rand as much as it once had. Not quite as much.
What had to be endured could be.
Discussing who was nearest, Korman and Javian left their men behind, but they still made quite a procession, with all the maidens in red shields following close, crowding the square-vaulted hallway. The corridor had a dark, heavy feel, despite lighted stand lamps. There was very little color anywhere, except in occasional tapestries, and the Kyrianen tried to make up for it by having everything rigidly arranged, whether embroidered flowers or birds, deer or leopards in a hunt, or nobles in battle. For the Kyrianen servants who scurried out of the way, livery usually meant colored stripes on the cuffs and a house badge embroidered on the breast, sometimes a collar or sleeves in house colors, very seldom an entire coat or dress. Only upper servants would show more color. Kyrianen liked order and disliked flamboyance. An occasional niche held a golden bowl or a seafolk vase, but stark and worked with straight lines, trying to disguise their curves if they had any. Whenever the hall gave way to a square-columned colonnade, if there was a garden below, the walks made a precise grid, every flower bed the same size, shrubs and small trees rigidly pruned and spaced. Had the drought and heat allowed any flowers, he was sure they too would have bloomed in straight lines. Rand wished Dailin could see those bowls and vases. The Shido had carried away whatever they could lift all the way across Kyrian, and burned what they could when they could not carry it. But such behavior violated Jieto. The Aiel who followed Rand and had saved the city had taken, but by their rules, when they took a place in battle, they were allowed a fifth of what it held, and not a spoon more. Bale had agreed reluctantly to forego even that in Andor, but Rand thought no one without a list would believe anything had been taken here at all. For all their discussion, Korman and Javian failed to find either Ruark or Berelain before they were found themselves instead. The two came to meet Rand alone in one of the colonnades, without entourage, which only made him feel as though he was leading a parade himself. Ruark, in his cotton sore, gray streaking his dark red hair, towered over Berylaine, a pale, beautiful young woman in a blue and white dress, cut low enough to make Rand clear his throat when she curtsied. Shufa looped loosely around his neck, Ruark carried no weapon but a heavy Aiel knife. She wore the diadem of the First, a golden hawk in flight, in shining black hair that made waves to bare shoulders. Perhaps it was just as well Avienda had gone. Sometimes she had a violent way toward women she even thought were putting themselves forward with him. Suddenly he realized that Luz Theron was humming tunelessly. Something about it seemed troubling, but what? Humming. Like a man admiring a pretty woman who was not aware of him.
"Stop that!" Rand shouted inside his head. "Stop looking through my eyes!"
No telling whether he heard. Was there someone there to hear? But the humming stopped. Avian went to one knee, but Berylaine gestured him to rise almost absently.
"I trust all is well with my Lord Dragon and with Andor."
She had the sort of voice that made a man listen.
"And with your friends, Matt Cawthon and Perrin Ebarra as well."
"All is well," he told her. She always asked after Matt and Perrin. However often he told her, one was on his way to Tyr, and the other he had not seen since before going to the Waste. "And with you?" Berylaine glanced at Ruark as they fell in on either side of Rand, proceeding into the next stretch of corridor.
"As well as can be expected, my Lord Dragon."
"It is well, Randall Thor," Ruark said.
There was not much expression on his face, but then there seldom was. Rand knew both understood why he had put Berylaine in charge here.
Cold reasons.
The First Ruler to offer him alliance freely, he could trust her because she needed him, now more than ever since that alliance, to keep Tyr from Mayenne's throat. The High Lords had always tried to treat Mayenne like a province. Besides, a foreigner from a small nation hundreds of leagues south, she had no reason to favor one faction over another in Kyrian. She had no hope of seizing power. And she knew the running of a country. Hard reasons. Given how Aiel felt about Kyrianen and Kyrianen about Aiel, putting Ruark in charge would have led to bloodshed, and Kyrian had had enough of that. The arrangement seemed to be working out well. As with Samaradrid and Wyrmann and Tyr, the Kyrianen accepted a Mayenner as governor as much because she was not Aiel as because Rand appointed her. Berylaine did know what she was doing, and she at least listened to advice offered by Ruark, speaking for the clan chiefs remaining in Kyrian. No doubt she had to deal with the wise ones as well. They would give up meddling, which they did not see as such, a day after Aes Sedai did. But she had not mentioned them so far.
"And Egwene," Rand said. "Is she any better?"
Berylaine's lips compressed slightly. She did not like Egwene. But then Egwene did not like her. No reason for it, that he knew, but there it was. Ruark spread his hands.
"So far as Amys tells me."
As well as being a wise one, Amys was his wife. One of his wives. He had two. One of the odder Aiel customs, among many, Rand found odd.
"She says Egwene yet needs rest, light exercise, plenty of food and fresh air. I think she takes walks in the cool of the day."
Berylaine gave him a wry look. The faint sheen of perspiration on her face did not detract from her beauty, but of course Ruark was not sweating at all.
"I would like to see her,
if the wise ones permit," Rand added. The wise ones were as jealous of their prerogatives as any Aes Sedai he had ever met, making sure of them with sept chiefs, clan chiefs, and perhaps most of all with the Karakarn.
"But first we—"
A noise had been catching the edge of hearing as they approached another place where one wall of the corridor was replaced by balustrated columns. The clatter of practice swords. He glanced down in passing. At least that was his intention. What he saw in the stone-paved courtyard below stilled his tongue and stopped his feet. Under the eye of a stiff-backed Kyrianen, in a plain gray coat, a dozen sweat-drenched women flailed away in pairs, some wearing riding dresses with divided skirts, some men's coats and breeches. Most were awkward in the forms, if vigorous, while others flowed from stance to stance smoothly, yet swung the bundled lath blades hesitantly. All wore grim determination like a cloak, though grimness was likely to break into rueful laughter when one realized she had made a mistake. The stiff-backed fellow clapped his hands, and the panting women leaned on their practice swords, some working arms clearly unused to this. From beyond Rand's sight, servants darted out, bowing and curtsying right and left, as they proffered trays with pitchers and cups. But if they were servants, their livery was odd for Kyrian. They wore white. Dresses or coats and breeches, all pure white. "What is that?" he asked. Ruark made a disgusted sound.
"Some of the Kyrianan women are quite impressed with the maidens," Berylaine said, smiling. "They want to be maidens. Only of the sword, I suppose, not the spear."
Suelin stiffened indignantly, and hand-talk flashed among the maidens. The gestures seemed outraged.
"These are daughters of noble houses," Berylaine went on. "I let them stay here because their parents would not allow this. There are nearly a dozen schools in the city now that will teach the sword to women, but many need to sneak away to attend. It is not only women, of course. The younger Kyrianan in general seem very impressed with the Aiel. They are adopting Jieto."
"They are mangling it," Ruark growled. "Many ask about our ways, and who would not teach one who would learn what is proper? Even a tree-killer."
He looked ready to spit.
"But they take what they are told and change it."
"Not change, really," Berylaine protested. "Only adapt, I think."
Ruark's eyebrows rose a fraction, and she sighed. Avian's face was a picture of affront, seeing his ruler challenged. Neither Ruark nor Berylaine noticed. They were intent on Rand. He had the feeling this was an argument the pair had had often.
"They change it," Ruark repeated deliberately. "Those fools down there in white claim to be Gai Shain. Gai Shain!"
The other Aielman muttered. Hand-talk flickered among the maidens again. Avian began to look a trifle uneasy.
"What battle or raid were they taken in? What toe have they incurred? You confirm my ban on fighting in the city, Berylaine Peyron. Yet they fight duels wherever they think they'll not be found, and the loser puts on white. If one strikes another while both are armed, the one struck pleads for a duel, and if it is refused, puts on white. What is that to do with honor or obligation? They change everything and do things to make a Sharaman blush. It should be stopped, Randall Thor."
Berylaine's jaw firmed stubbornly, her hands tightening to fists on her skirts.
"Young men always fight."
Her tone was condescending enough that you might almost have forgotten she was young herself.
"But since they began this, not one has died in a duel. Not one. That alone is worth letting them go on. Besides which, I have faced down fathers and mothers, some powerful, who wanted their daughters sent home. I will not deny those young women what I promise them."
"Keep them, if you wish. Let them learn the sword, if they wish. But let them stop claiming to follow Jieto. Let there be an end to them putting on white and claiming to be Gai Shain. What they do offends."
His chill blue eyes were fixed on Berylaine, but her large dark eyes remained steady on Rand. He hesitated only a moment. He thought he understood what drove the younger Kyrianan to Jieto. Twice conquered by Aiel in 20-odd years, they had to wonder whether the secret lay there. Or maybe they thought their defeats just showed that the Aiel way was better. Clearly the Aiel were upset by what they saw as a mockery of their beliefs, but in truth, some of the ways Aiel became Gai Shain seemed no less peculiar. For instance, speaking to a man of his father-in-law or to a woman of her mother-in-law, second father and second mother in the Aiel way,
was considered hostile enough to justify drawing weapons unless they had mentioned them first. If the offended party instead touched you after you spoke, under Giotto it was the same as touching an armed enemy without harming him. That gained much G, and incurred much toe. But the one touched could demand to be made Gaishin to lessen the other's honor and their own obligation. By Giotto, a proper demand to be made Gaishin had to be honored, so a man or woman could end up Gaishin for mentioning somebody's mother-in-law. Hardly less foolish than what these Kyrianen were doing. Really, it came down to one thing, though. He had put Berlin in charge. He had to support her. It was as simple as that. Kyrianen offend you by being Kyrianen, Ruark. Leave them be. Who knows? Maybe they will eventually learn enough that you won't have to hate them anymore. Ruark grunted sourly, and Berlin smiled. To Rand's surprise, for one moment she seemed about to put her tongue out at the Aielman. Only his imagination, of course. She was only a few years older than himself, but she had been ruling Mayenne while he was still guarding sheep in the Two Rivers. Sending Corman and Javien back to their guard, Rand moved on, with Ruark and Berlain to either side, and the rest following close. A parade. All it needed was drums and trumpets. The clatter of practice swords started up again behind him. Another change, however small. Even Moiraine, who had long studied the prophecies of the dragon, had not known whether his breaking the world again meant he would bring on a new age. But he was certainly bringing changes one way and another. As many by accident, it seemed, as on purpose. When they reached the door of the study Berlain and Ruark shared, rising suns decorated the long panels of dark polished wood, indicating some royal use once. Rand stopped, turning to Sulin and Urien. If he could not dispense with all these guards here, there was nowhere he could. I mean to return to Camlann an hour or so after sunrise tomorrow. Until then, visit the tents, see your friends, and try not to start any blood feuds. If you insist, two of you can hang about to protect me from mice. I don't think anything larger will jump out at me here. Urien grinned slightly and nodded, though he did gesture about head high to a Kyrianen and murmur, "The mice can be big here." For an instant, Rand thought Sulin meant to argue. Her flat stare lasted only a moment, though, before she nodded. Still tight-mouthed, however. Doubtless he would hear the argument in full once there were only maidens to hear. A large room, the study presented sharp contrasts, even at his second sight of it. On the high worked plaster ceiling, straight lines and sharp angles made elaborately repeating patterns, and around the walls, as well as on a wide fireplace, faced with deep blue marble. A massive table stood in the middle of the floor, covered with papers and maps, making a boundary of sorts. The two tall, narrow windows to one side of the fireplace held clay pots on deep stools, filled with small plants that showed a few tiny red and white blossoms. On that side of the table, a long wall hanging showed ships at sea and men hauling nets filled with oilfish, the source of Mayenne's wealth. An embroidery hoop with needle and red thread dangling from a piece of half-finished work sat in a high-backed chair wide enough for Berlain to curl up in if she wished. There was a single carpet on the floor in flower-like patterns of gold and red and blue, and a small table beside the chair held a silver wine pitcher and goblets on a silver tray, as well as a slim book bound in red with a gold-worked piece of leather marking Berlain's place. The floor on the other side of the table was layered in brightly colored rugs with tasseled cushions of red and blue and green scattered about. A tabak pouch, a short-stemmed pipe, and a pair of tongs sat beside a covered brass bowl atop a small brass-bound chest, while a slightly larger chest, strapped with iron, held an ivory carving of a gawky animal Rand doubted really existed. 2 dozen books of all sizes, from small enough to fit in a coat pocket to large enough that even Ruark must need both hands to pick them up, made a neat row across the floor along the wall. Aiel made everything in the waste that they needed except books. Peddlers had made fortunes among Aiel, hauling nothing but books. "Now," Rand said when the door was closed, leaving him alone with Ruark and Berylaine. "How are things really?"
"As I said," Berylaine replied, "as well as can be expected. There is more talk of Caroline Domadred and Toram Riotan in the streets, but most people are too tired to want another war for a time."
"It is said 10,000 Andaman soldiers have joined them." Ruark began thumbing his pipe full. "Rumor always multiplies by 10, when not 20. Yet it is troubling, if true. The scouts say their numbers are not large, but left to grow, they could be more than an annoyance. The yellow fly is almost too small to see, but if you leave its egg in your skin, you will lose an arm or leg before it hatches, if it does not kill you." Rand grunted noncommittally. Darlin's rebellion in Tyr was not the only one he had to face. House Riotan and House Damodred, the last two to hold the Sun Throne, had been bitter rivals before Rand had appeared, and likely would be again if he disappeared. Now they had put rivalry aside, on the surface at least. What went on below the surface with Cariannon could be something else entirely. And, like Darlin, meant to gather strength somewhere Toram and Caroline thought safe. In their case, the foothills of the spine of the world, as far from the city as they could be, and remain in the country. They had gathered the same mix as Darlin, nobles mainly of middle rank, displaced country folk, some outright mercenaries, and perhaps a few former brigands. Niall's hand might be there as well, as it was with Darlin. Those foothills were not nearly so impenetrable as Haddon Merc, but Rand held his hand. He had too many enemies in too many places. If he paused to swat Ruark's yellow fly here, he might find a leopard on his back somewhere else. He had it in mind to take the leopard first. If only he knew where all the other leopards were. "What of the Shido?" he asked, setting the dragon scepter down on a half-unrolled map. It showed the north of Cairhien and the mountains called Kinslayer's Dagger. The Shido might not be as big a leopard as Samael, but they were a sight bigger than High Lord Darlin or Lady Caroline. Berylaine handed him a goblet of wine, and he thanked her. "Have the Wise Ones said anything at all about Sivana's intentions?" He would have thought at least one or two could listen and look around just a little when she journeyed up to Kinslayer's Dagger. He would wager the Shido Wise Ones did when they came below the River Galen. He said neither thing, of course. The Shido might have abandoned Geato, but Ruark had a traditional Aiel view of spying. The Wise Ones' views were another thing again, though exactly what could be hard to pin down. "They say the Shido are building holds." Ruark paused, using a pair of tongs to hold a hot coal from the sand-filled brass bowl over his pipe.
When he had it puffed alight, he went on.
"They do not think the Shido ever mean to return to the Threefold Land. Nor do I."
Rand scrubbed his free hand through his hair. Caroline and Toram festering, and the Shido settling in this side of the Dragon Wall. A far more dangerous brew than Darlin. And Alana's unseen finger seemed on the point of touching him. "Is there any other good news?"
"There is fighting in Shamara," Ruark said around his pipe stem.
"Where?" Rand asked.
"Shamara, or Shara. They give many names for their land. Kodansin, Tomaka, Kigali, others. Any could be true, or none. They lie without thought, those people. Unwind every bolt of silk you trade for, or find that only the outside is silk. And if the next time in the trade hold you happen to find the man who traded with you, he will deny seeing you before or coming to trade before. If you press it, the others kill him to appease you, then say only he could do anything concerning the silk, and try to trade you water as wine."
"Why is fighting in Shara good news?" Rand asked softly. He did not really want to hear the answer. Berylaine was listening with interest. No one except the Aiel and the Seafolk knew much more of the closed lands beyond the waste than that ivory and silk came from there. That and the tales in the Travels of Jay and Farstrider, which were probably too fanciful to be true. Though come to think of it, Rand did remember the lying being mentioned, and the different names. Except the examples Farstrider had given matched none of Ruark's, as far as he could recall.
"There is never fighting in Shara, Randalthor. It is said the Trolloc Wars infested them."
Trollocs had entered the Aiel Waste, too. Since then, the Trolloc name for the Aiel Waste was the Dying Ground.
"But if there has been one battle since, no word of it has come to the trade holds. Not much word of anything outside the hold walls does come inside. They say their land has always been one, not many, as here. Always at peace. When you came from Ruidian as the Karakarn, word of you spread, and of your title among the wetlanders here, the Dragon Reborn. Word traveled to the trade holds along the Great Rift and the Cliffs of Dawn."
Ruark's eyes were calm and steady. This did not trouble him.
"Now word comes back across the threefold land. There is fighting in Shara, and Shara men in the trade holds ask when the Dragon Reborn will break the world."
Suddenly the wine tasted sour. Another place like Taraban and Arad-Doman, torn just by hearing of him. How far did the ripples spread? Were there wars he would never hear of, in lands he would never hear of, because of him?
"Death rides on my shoulder," Luz Theron muttered. "Death walks in my footsteps. I am death."
Shuddering, Rand set his goblet on the table. How much did the prophecies demand in all those tantalizing hints and grandly roundabout verses? Was he supposed to add Shara, or whatever it was really called, to Kyrian and the rest? The entire world? How, when he could not even hold Tyr or Kyrian completely? It would take more than one man's lifetime. Andor. If he was meant to rip every other land apart, rip the whole world, he would hold Andor safe for Elaine. Somehow.
Shara, or whatever it's called, is a long way from here. One step at a time. And Samael is the first step.
Samael, Ruark agreed. Berylaine shivered and emptied her goblet. For a time they talked of the Aiel, who were still moving south. Rand intended the hammer being made in Tyr to be clearly big enough to smash anything Samael could put in its way. Ruark seemed content. It was Berylaine who complained that more needed to be kept in Kyrian. Until Ruark shushed her. She muttered something about him being too stubborn for his own good, but she went on to the efforts to resettle farmers on the land. She thought by next year there would be no need for grain from Tyr. If the drought ever broke. If it did not, Tyr would not be supplying grain to itself, much less anywhere else. The first tendrils of trade were beginning to reappear. Merchants had begun coming in from Andor and Tyr and Murundi, down from the borderlands. A seafolk ship had even dropped anchor in the river that very morning, which she found strange, so far from the sea, but welcome. Berylaine's face took on an intensity, and her voice a brisk tone as she moved around the table to take up this sheaf of papers or that, discussing what Kyrian needed to buy and what it could afford to buy, what it had to sell now, and what it would have in 6 months, in a year. Depending on the weather, of course. She brushed by that as if it was of no matter, though giving Rand a level look that said he was the Dragon Reborn, and if there was any way to stop the heat, he should find it. Rand had seen her meltingly seductive. He had seen her frightened, defiant, wrapped in arrogance. But never like this. She seemed a different woman altogether. Ruark, seated on one of his cushions, puffing on his pipe, appeared amused as he watched her.
"This school of yours might do some good," she said, frowning at a long sheet covered in a precise hand, "if they would stop thinking of new things long enough to make what they have already thought of."
She tapped her lips with a finger, peering at nothing thoughtfully.
"You say give them what gold they ask, but if you would let me hold back, unless they actually—"
Jelani put her plump face in at the door. Aiel seemed not to understand knocking and said,
"Mangan is here to speak with Ruark and you, Randall Thor."
"Tell him I'll be happy to talk with him later."
Rand got that far before Ruark broke in quietly.
"You should speak with him now, Randall Thor."
The clan chief's face looked grave. Berlane had replaced the long paper on the table and was studying the floor.
"Very well," Rand said slowly.
Jelani's head vanished and Mangan came in.
Taller than Rand, he had been one of those who crossed the Dragon Wall in search of He Who Comes with the Dawn, one of the handful who took the Stone of Tyr.
6 days ago I killed a man," he began without preamble, "a tree killer. And I must know if I have told to you, Randall Thor."
"To me," Rand said. "You can defend yourself, Mangan. Light, you know that—"
For a moment he was silent, meeting gray eyes that were sober but certainly not afraid. Curious, maybe. Ruark's face told him nothing. Berlane was still not meeting his gaze.
"He did attack you, didn't he?"
Mangan shook his head slightly.
"I saw that he deserved to die, so I killed him."
He said it conversationally. He saw the drains needed cleaning, so he cleaned them.
"But you have said we cannot kill the Oathbreakers except in battle, or if they attack us. Do I have toe toward you now?"
Rand remembered what he had said. "Him will I hang." His chest felt tight. "Why did he deserve to die?"
"He wore what he had no right to," Mangan replied.
"Wore what? What did he wear, Mangan?"
Ruark answered, touching his left forearm.
"This."
He meant the dragon coiled around his arm.
Clan chiefs did not display them often, or even speak of them. Almost everything about the markings were shrouded in mystery, and the chiefs were content to leave it so.
"It was a thing of needles and inks, of course.
A tattoo."
"He was pretending to be a clan chief?"
Rand realized he was searching for an excuse. "Him will I hang." Mangan had been one of the first to follow him.
"No," Mangan said. "He was drinking and showing off what he should not have."
"I see your eyes, Randall Thor."
He grinned suddenly.
"It is a puzzle. I was right to kill him, but now I have toe to you."
"You were wrong to kill him. You know the penalty for murder."
"A rope around the neck, as these wetlanders use."
Mangan nodded thoughtfully.
"Tell me where and when. I will be there."
"May you find water and shade today, Randall Thor."
"May you find water and shade, Mangan,"
Rand told him sadly.
"I suppose," Berlane said when the door closed behind Mangan, "that he really will walk to his own hanging of his own accord." "Oh, don't look at me that way, Ruark. I don't mean to impugn him, or Aiel Honor."
6 days, Rand growled, rounding on her.
"You knew why he was here, both of you. 6 days ago, and you left it to me. Murder is murder, Berlane."
She drew herself up regally, but she sounded defensive.
"I am not used to men coming to me and saying they have just committed murder. Bloody Geato, bloody Aielman, and their bloody honor."
The curses sounded odd coming from her mouth.
"You have no cause to be angry with her, Randall Thor,"
Ruark put in.
"Mangan's toe is to you, not to her, or to me." "His toe was to the man he murdered," Rand said coldly.
Ruark looked shocked.
"The next time somebody commits murder, don't wait for me. You follow the law."
That way, perhaps, he would not have to pass sentence again on a man he knew and liked. He would if he had to. He knew that, and it saddened him. What had he become?
"The wheel of a man's life," Luz Theron murmured. "No mercy, no pity."
Chapter 18.
A Taste of Solitude.
Are there any more problems you want me to deal with?
Rand's tone made it clear he meant problems they should have already solved.
Ruark shook his head slightly.
Berlane's face reddened as well.
Good. Set a date for Mangan's hanging.
If it hurts too much, Luz Theron laughed in a hoarse whisper, make it hurt someone else instead.
His responsibility, his duty. He stiffened his back to keep that mountain from crushing him.
Hang him tomorrow. Tell him I said so.
He paused, glaring, then realized he was waiting for Luz Theron's comment, not theirs. Waiting for a dead man's voice. A dead madman.
I'm going to the school.
Ruark pointed out that the Wise Ones were probably on their way from the tents, and Berylane, that Tyrion and Cairhienin nobles alike, would be clamoring to know where she was hiding Rand. But he told them to tell the truth, and tell the lot of them not to follow him. He would return when he returned. The pair looked as if they had swallowed sour plums, but he snatched up the dragon scepter and left. In the hallway, Jelani and a yellow-haired Redshield, not much older than she, came smoothly to their feet, glancing at one another hastily. Otherwise, the corridor was empty, except for a few scurrying servants. One of each, it figured, though Rand wondered whether Urien had had to wrestle Sulin to make it so. Motioning them to follow, he went straight down to the nearest stable, where the stalls were the same green marble as the columns that held the high ceiling. The head groom, a gnarled fellow with big ears, the rising son of Cairhien worked on his short leather vest, was so shocked by Rand appearing with only two Aiel for escort that he kept staring at the stable doors for more and bowed so often between stares that Rand wondered whether he would ever get a horse. But once the man shouted, "A horse for the Lord Dragon!" six stablemen leaped to prepare a tall, fiery-eyed bay gelding with a gold-fringed bridle and a gold-worked saddle atop a sky-blue saddlecloth fringed and embroidered with rising suns in gold. As quickly as they moved, the big-eared head groom was gone by the time Rand swung into the saddle. To hunt for the coterie of followers the Dragon Reborn must have, possibly. Or to tell someone Rand was leaving the palace practically alone. Cairhien was like that. The sleek bay wanted to frisk, but while still trying to settle his dancing, Rand trotted him out of the palace grounds, past startled Cairhienin guards. He was not worried about assassins laying in ambush from the big-eared man's warning. Anyone who ambushed him would find they had come to the shearing without clippers. Any delay, though, and likely he would have nobles crowding around so thickly he could not leave without them. It felt good to be alone for a change. He glanced at Jelani and the young Aielman trotting beside the bay. Dedric, he thought. A Jaren Rift Kodara. Almost alone. He could feel Alana still, and Luz Theron moaned in the far distance over his dead Ilyena. He could never be entirely alone, maybe never again. What he had of solitude felt good, though, after so long. Cairhien was a large city, its major streets wide enough to dwarf the people crowding them. Each street slashed arrow straight through hills, carved and stone-terraced, until they seemed man-made, meeting every other street at a right angle. Throughout the city rose huge towers wrapped in wooden scaffolding that nearly hid elaborate square-arched buttresses, towers that seemed to touch the sky and meant to go higher. 20 years since the fabled topless towers of Cairhien, a wonder of the world, had burned like torches during the Aiel War, and their rebuilding was still not done. Making a way was not easy. The trotting did not last. Rand had grown accustomed to crowds opening before his usual escort, yet with hundreds of Cottonsore-clad Aiel just within his sight among the slow-flowing throng, it was not quite the same, not for only two. Some of those Aiel recognized him, he thought, but they ignored him. Not about to cause embarrassment by calling attention when the Ka-Karn wore a sword, and, not as bad, but hardly to be applauded, rode a horse. To Aiel, shame and embarrassment were far worse than pain, though, of course, Jia To had to complicate things with degrees Rand understood only in part.
Avienda could explain it, certainly. She seemed to want him to become Aiel. Plenty of others jammed the streets, too. Kyrianen in their usual drab clothing, and also in the shabby bright colors of those who had lived in the foregate before it burned. Tyrans, a head taller in the crowd, if not as tall as the Aiel. Ox carts and horse-drawn wagons threaded through the throng, yielding way to closed lacquer carriages and sedan chairs, sometimes with a house banner. Hawkers cried wares from trays and peddlers from push-carts. Musicians, tumblers, and jugglers performed on street corners. Both were changes. Once Kyrian had been quiet, subdued, except in the foregate. Some of that sobriety still held. The shops still had small signs displaying no goods outside. And if the former foregaters seemed raucous as ever, laughing loudly and shouting at one another, arguing right there in the street, the other Kyrianen still eyed them with prim distaste. No one but Aiel recognized the bareheaded horseman in a silver-worked blue coat, though occasionally someone glanced twice at his saddlecloth. The dragon scepter was not well known here yet. Nobody gave way. Rand felt torn between impatience and the pleasure of not being the focus of every eye. The school occupied a palace a mile from the Sun Palace, once the property of one Lord Barthanas, now dead and unlamented. A great heap of stone squares with sharply angular towers and severe balconies. The tall gates onto the main courtyard stood open, and when Rand rode in, he found a welcome. Idrian Tarson, who headed the school, stood on the broad steps at the far end of the courtyard, a stocky woman in a plain gray dress, straight-backed enough to seem a head taller than she was. She was not alone. Dozens and dozens of others crowded the stone steps, men and women in wool much more often than silk, frequently worn and seldom ornamented. Older folk, mainly. Idrian was not the only one with more gray than black in her hair, or no black at all, or no hair at all, though here and there a younger face peered eagerly at Rand. Younger meaning 10 or 15 years older than he. They were the teachers, in a way, though this was not exactly a school. Pupils did come to learn, young men and women hung gaping out of every window around the courtyard now, but for the most part, Rand had wanted to gather knowledge in one place. Time and again he had heard how much had been lost in the War of the 100 Years and the Trolloc Wars. How much more must have vanished in the breaking of the world. If he was going to break the world again, he meant to create repositories where knowledge could be preserved. Another school had already started in Tyr, though just barely, and he had begun seeking a place in Camelin. "Nothing ever goes as you expect," Luz Theron murmured. "Expect nothing, and you will not be surprised. Expect nothing. Hope for nothing. Nothing." Suppressing the voice, Rand dismounted. Idrian came to meet him with a curtsy. As usual, when she rose, it was something of a shock to realize yet again that she was barely as tall as his chest.
"Welcome to the school of Kyrian, my lord dragon."
Her voice was surprisingly sweet and youthful, a startling contrast to her blunt face. He had heard it harden, though, with students and teachers. Idrian held a tight rein on the school. "How many spies do you have in the Sun Palace?" he asked mildly. She looked startled, perhaps that he would suggest such a thing, but more likely because the question was not proper manners in Kyrian.
"We have prepared a small display."
Well, he had not really expected an answer. She eyed the two Aiel like a woman eyeing two large and muddy dogs of uncertain temperament, but contented herself with a sniff.
"If my lord dragon will follow me?"
He followed, frowning. A display of what? The entry hall of the school was a vast chamber of polished dark gray columns and pale gray floor tiles, with a gray-veined marble balcony all the way around 3 spans up. Now it was largely filled with contraptions. The teachers crowding in behind him went running to them. Rand stared, suddenly remembering what Berlane had said about the school making things. But what? Idrian told him, after a fashion, leading him from one to the next, where men and women explained what they had created. He even understood some of it.
An array of screens and scrapers and crocks full of linen scraps produced finer paper than anyone made now, or so its inventor said. A great hulking shape of levers and huge flat plates was a printing press, much better than those already in use, according to its maker. Dedrick showed considerable interest in that, until Jelani apparently decided he should be watching for somebody trying to attack the Ka Karn. She trod hard on his foot, and he limped after Rand. There was a plow on wheels meant to turn 6 furrows at once. Rand could recognize that, at least. He thought it might work. And another thing with shafts for horses that was meant to harvest hay in place of men with scythes. And a new sort of loom that was easier to operate, so the fellow who made it said. There were painted wooden models of viaducts to carry water to places where the wells were going dry, of new drains and sewers for Kyrian, even a tabletop exhibit with tiny figures of men in carts, cranes, and rollers meant to show how roads could be built and paved as well as they had in years long gone. Rand did not know whether any of it would work, but some looked worth trying. That plow, for instance, could be handy if Kyrian was ever to feed itself again. He would tell Idrian to build it. No, he would tell Berylaine to tell her.
"Always follow lines of authority in public view," Moraine had said, "unless you mean to undercut someone and bring them down."
Among the teachers he knew was Kin Tovir, a stocky lensmaker who kept wiping his bald head with a striped handkerchief. Aside from looking glasses in various sizes, "Count the hairs in a man's nose at a mile," he said. That was how he talked. He had a lens as big across as his head, a sketch of the looking glass to hold it, and more like it, a thing 6 paces long and a scheme for looking at the stars, of all things. Well, Kin always wanted to look at things far off. Idrian wore a look of quiet satisfaction while Rand studied Master Tavir's sketch. She was not much for anything but the practical. During the siege of Kyrian, she herself had built a huge crossbow, all levers and pulleys, that hurled a small spear a full mile hard enough to drive through a man. Had she her way, there would be no time wasted on anything not real and solid. "Build it," Rand told Kin. Maybe it was of no real use, not like the plow, but he liked Tovir. Idrian sighed and shook her head. Tovir beamed. "And I'm giving you a prize of 100 gold crowns. This looks interesting." That produced a buzz, and it was close whether Idrian's jaw or Tovir's dropped farther. Other things in the hall made Tovir seem as level-headed as the would-be road-builder. The round-faced fellow who did something with cow dung that ended with a bluish flame burning at the end of a brass tube, even he did not seem to know what it was for. The lanky young woman whose display was mainly a shell of paper moored by strings and kept aloft by the heat rising from a small fire in a brazier. She mumbled something about flying. He was sure that was what she said. And birds' wings being curved. She had sketches of birds, and of what seemed to be wooden birds. But she was so tongue-tied meeting the dragon reborn that he could not understand another word, and Idrian certainly could not explain what it was about. And then there was the balding man with an assemblage of brass tubes and cylinders, rods and wheels, all covering a heavy wooden table freshly gouged and scraped, some gouges nearly deep enough to pierce the tabletop. For some reason, half the man's face and one of his hands were swathed in bandages. As soon as Rand appeared in the entry hall, he had begun anxiously building a fire under one of the cylinders. When Rand and Idrian stopped in front of him, he moved a lever and smiled proudly. The contraption began to quiver, steam hissing out from 2 or 3 places. The hiss grew to a shriek, and the thing began trembling. It groaned ominously. The shriek became ear-piercing. It shook so hard the table moved. The balding man threw himself at the table, fumbling a plug loose on the largest cylinder. Steam rushed out in a cloud, and the thing went still. Sucking burned fingers, the man managed a weak grin. "Very nice brasswork," Rand said before letting Idrian lead him away. "What was that?" he asked quietly when they were out of earshot. She shrugged.
"Mervyn will not tell anyone. Sometimes there are bangs in his rooms loud enough to make doors tremble,
and he has scalded himself 6 times so far, but he claims it will bring a new age when he makes it work.
She glanced at Rand uneasily. Mervyn is welcome to bring it if he can, Lee told her dryly. Maybe the thing was supposed to make music. All those shrieks?
I don't see Herod. Did he forget to come down?
Idrian sighed again.
Herod Fell was an Andoran who somehow had ended up reading in the royal library here, a student of history and philosophy, he called himself, and hardly the sort to endear himself to her.
My lord dragon, he never comes out of his study except to go to the library.
Getting away required a small speech, delivered standing on a stool, with the dragon scepter in the crook of his arm, telling them that their creations were wonderful. Some might be, for all he knew. Then he was able to slip off with Jelani and Dedric, and Luz Theron and Alana. They left behind a pleased babble. He wondered whether any besides Idrian had ever thought of making a weapon.
Herod Fell's study lay on an upper floor, where the view was of nothing much but the dark tile roofs of the school, and one square-stepped tower that blocked off anything else. Herod claimed he never looked out of the windows anyway.
"You can wait out here," Rand said on reaching the narrow door. The room inside was narrow, too, and was surprised when Jelani and Dedric agreed right away. A number of small things suddenly came together. Jelani had not given his sword one disapproving look, something she made a point of, since he came out of the meeting with Ruark and Berylane. Neither she nor Dedric had so much as glanced at the horse in the stable, or made a disparaging remark about how his own legs should be good enough for him, another thing she did regularly.
As if for confirmation, as Rand turned to the door, Jelani briefly eyed Dedric up and down. Briefly, but with decidedly open interest and a smile. Dedric ignored her so intently he might as well have stared. That was the Aiel way, pretending not to understand until she made herself clearer. She would have done the same had he begun the looking.
"Enjoy yourselves," Rand said over his shoulder, producing 2 startled stares, and went inside.
The small room was all books and scrolls and sheafs of paper, or so it appeared. Crowded shelves walled the room to the ceiling, except for the doorway and 2 open windows. Books and papers covered the table that took up most of the floor, lay in a jumble on the extra chair, even here and there on the little remaining of the floor. Herod Fell himself was a stout man who looked as if he had forgotten to brush his thin gray hair this morning. The pipe clenched in his teeth was unlit, and pipe ash sprinkled the front of his rumpled brown coat. He blinked at Rand for a moment, then said,
"Ah, yes, of course. I was about to—"
He frowned at the book in his hands, then sat down behind the table and fingered through some loose sheets of paper in front of him, muttering quietly. Turning to the title page of the book, he scratched his head. Finally, he looked back at Rand and blinked in surprise again.
"Oh, yes. What was it you wanted to talk about?"
Rand cleared the second chair, putting the books and papers on the floor, propped the dragon scepter on the pile, and sat down. He had tried talking with others here, philosophers and historians, learned women and scholars, and it was like trying to pin down an Aes Sedai. They were very certain of what they were certain of, and about the rest, they drowned you in words that could mean anything. They either grew angry when pressed, they seemed to think he was doubting their knowledge, apparently a deep sin, or they increased the torrent of words till he did not know what half of them meant, or they became obsequious, trying to find out what he wanted to hear so they could tell it to him. Herod was different. One of the things that always seemed to slip his mind was that Rand was the dragon reborn, which suited Rand very well. "What do you know about Aes Sedai and warders, Herod? About the bond?"
"Warders? Bond? As much as anybody not Aes Sedai, I suppose. Which isn't saying much, mind."
Herod sucked at his pipe, not seeming to realize it had gone out.
"What did you want to know?"
"Can it be broken?"
"Broken? Oh, no. I don't think so. Unless you mean when the warder or the Aes Sedai dies. That breaks it, I think.
I remember hearing something about the bond once, but I can't remember.
Catching sight of a sheaf of notes on his table, Herod drew it to him with his fingertips and began reading, frowning and shaking his head. The notes looked to be in his own hand, but he did not seem to agree with them anymore. Rand sighed. He almost thought if he turned his head quickly enough, he would see Alana's hand poised over him.
"What about the question I posed you last time?"
"Herod?"
"Herod?"
The stout man's head jerked up.
"Oh, yes. Question. Last time. Tarmageddon. Well, I don't know what it will be like. Trollocs, I suppose. Dreadlords. Yes, dreadlords. But I've been thinking. It can't be the last battle. I don't think it can. Maybe every age has a last battle, or most of them."
Suddenly he frowned down his nose at the pipe in his teeth and began rummaging across the table.
"I have a tinder box here somewhere."
"What do you mean it can't be the last battle?" Rand tried to keep his voice smooth. Herod always came to the point. You just had to prod him toward it.
"What? Yes, exactly the point. It can't be the last battle. Even if the dragon reborn seals the Dark One's prison again, as well as the Creator made it. Which I don't think he can do."
He leaned forward and lowered his voice conspiratorially.
"He isn't the Creator, you know. Whatever they say in the streets. Still, it has to be sealed up again by somebody. The wheel, you see."
"I don't see..." Rand trailed off.
"Yes, you do. You'd make a good student."
Snatching his pipe out, Herod drew a circle in the air with the stem.
"The Wheel of Time. Ages come and go and come again as the wheel turns. Oh, the Catechism."
Suddenly he stabbed a point on that imaginary wheel.
"Here, the Dark One's prison is whole. Here, they drilled a hole in it and sealed it up again."
He moved the bit of the pipe along the arc he had drawn.
"Here we are. The seal's weakening. But that doesn't matter, of course."
The pipe stem completed the circle.
"When the wheel turns back to here, back to where they drilled the hole in the first place, the Dark One's prison has to be whole again."
"Why? Maybe the next time they'll drill through the patch. Maybe that's how they could do it the last time. Drill into what the Creator made, I mean. Maybe they drilled the bore through a patch, and we just don't know." Herod shook his head. For a moment he stared at his pipe, once more realizing it was unlit, and Rand thought he might have to recall him again, but instead Herod blinked and went on.
"Someone had to make it sometime. For the first time, that is. Unless you think the Creator made the Dark One's prison with a hole and patch to begin."
His eyebrows waggled at the suggestion.
"No. It was whole in the beginning, and I think it will be whole again when the Third Age comes once more. I wonder if they called it the Third Age."
He hastily dipped a pen and scribbled a note in the margins of an open book.
"No matter now. I'm not saying the Dragon Reborn will be the one to make it whole. Not in this age, necessarily, anyway. But it must be so before the Third Age comes again. And enough time passed since it was made whole, an age at least, that no one remembers the Dark One or his prison. No one remembers. I wonder..."
He peered at his notes and scratched his head, then seemed startled to find he used the hand holding the pipe. There was a smudge of ink in his hair.
"Any age where seals weaken must remember the Dark One eventually, because they will have to face him and wall him up again."
Sticking his pipe back between his teeth, he tried to make another note without dipping the pen.
"Unless the Dark One breaks free," Rand said quietly. "To break the Wheel of Time and remake time and the world in his own image."
"There is that."
Herod shrugged, frowning at the pen. Finally, he thought of the inkpot.
"I don't suppose there's much you or I can do about it. Why don't you come study here with me? I don't suppose Tarmageddon will happen tomorrow. And it would be as good a use of your time as..."
"Is there any reason you can think of to break the seals?"
Herod's eyebrows shot up.
"Break the seals? Break the seals? Why would anyone but a madman want to do that? Can they even be broken? I seem to remember reading somewhere they can't. But I don't recall now that it said why. What made you think a thing like that?"
"I don't know," Rand sighed.
In the back of his head, Luz Theron was chanting,
"Break the seals, break the seals, and end it. Let me die forever."
Fanning herself idly with a corner of her shawl, Egwene peered both ways down the crossing hallway, hoping she had not gotten lost again. She was very much afraid she had, and not pleased if it was so. The Sun Palace had miles of corridor, none much cooler than outside, and she had spent little time in them to learn her way. There were maidens everywhere in twos and threes, far more than Rand normally brought with him, certainly far more than usual when he was not there. They simply appeared to be strolling, but to her something about them seemed furtive. A number knew her by sight, and she might have expected a friendly word. The maidens especially seemed to have decided that being a pupil of the Wise Ones outweighed being Aes Sedai, as they thought she was, to the point that she was not Aes Sedai any longer. But when they saw her, they looked as startled as an Aiel was likely to look. Acknowledging nods came a beat late, and they hurried on without speaking. It was not behavior conducive to asking directions. Instead, she frowned at a sweaty-faced servant with thin blue and gold stripes on his cuffs, wondering whether he knew how to get where she wanted to go from here. The difficulty was she was not exactly sure where it was she did want to go. Unfortunately, the fellow was plainly on edge with so many Aiel about. Seeing an Aiel woman frowning at him, they never seemed to notice her dark eyes, which certainly no Aiel had, and his head probably full of tales about the maidens, he turned and ran as hard as he could. She sniffed irritably. She did not really need directions anyway. Sooner or later she had to come on something she recognized. Certainly no point in going back the way she had come, but which of the other three? Choosing one, she strode off firmly, and even some of the maidens stepped out of her way. In truth, she was feeling a bit grumpy. Seeing Avienda again after all this time would have been wonderful if the woman had not simply nodded to her coolly and ducked into a private conference in Amice's tent. Private indeed, Egwene learned when she tried to follow. "You were not summoned," Amice had said sharply, while Avienda sat cross-legged on a cushion, staring dejectedly at the layered carpets in front of her. "Go and take a walk, and eat something. A woman is not meant to look like a reed." Bear and Milane had come hurrying, summoned by Guy Shine, but Egwene was excluded. It had helped a little seeing a string of Wise Ones turned away too, though only a little. After all, she was Avienda's friend, and if she was in some sort of trouble, Egwene wanted to help. "Why are you here?" Sorilia's voice demanded behind her. Egwene was proud of herself. She turned calmly to face the Wise One of Shenda Hold. A Jarachareen, Sorilia had thin white hair, and a face that was leathery skin pulled tight over her skull. She was all sinew and bone, and though she could channel, she had less strength in the power than most novices Egwene had met. In fact, in the tower she certainly would never have gone beyond novice before being sent away. Of course, channeling did not really count for much among Wise Ones. Whatever the mysterious rules governing Wise Ones, when Cerulea was about, leadership always settled on her. Egwene thought it was pure strength of will. A good head taller than Egwene, as most Aiel women were, Cerulea stared at her with a green-eyed gaze that could knock a bull off its feet. That was a relief. It was Cerulea's normal way of looking at everyone. Had she a bone to pick, the walls would have been crumbling wherever she looked, and tapestries catching fire. Well, that was how it seemed, anyway. "I've come to see Rand," Egwene said. Walking in from the tents seemed as good exercise as any. Certainly better than walking 5 or 6 times briskly around the city walls, the usual Aiel notion of light exercise. She hoped Cerulea did not ask why. She truly did not like lying to any of the Wise Ones. Cerulea stared at her a moment as if she had sniffed something hidden, then hitched her shawl up on narrow shoulders and said, "He is not here. He has gone to his school. Berylaine Pearin suggests it would not be wise to follow him, and I agree." Keeping her face smooth was an effort for Egwene. That the Wise Ones would take to Berylaine had been the last thing she expected. They treated her as a woman of sense and respect, which made no sense at all to Egwene, and not because Rand had given her authority. They cared not a twig for any wetlander authority. It seemed ridiculous. The Mayanner woman flaunted herself in scandalous clothes and flirted outrageously, when she did not do more than flirt, as Egwene darkly believed she did. Not at all the sort of woman for Amys to smile on like a favorite daughter, or Cerulea. Unbidden thoughts of Gawain floated up in her head. It had only been a dream, and his dream at that. Certainly nothing like what Berylaine did. "When a young woman's cheeks redden for no apparent reason," Cerulea said, "there is usually a man involved. What man has attracted your interest? Can we expect to see you lay a bridal wreath at his feet soon?" "Aes Sedai seldom marry," Egwene told her coolly. The leather-faced woman's snort sounded like cloth ripping. The maidens and the wise ones, indeed all the Aiel, might have decided she was not Aes Sedai so long as she studied with Amys and the others, but Cerulea took it further. She seemed to think Egwene had become Aiel. Added to which, there was nowhere Cerulea did not think she had a right to stick her finger. "You will, girl. You are not one to become far Dar Ismai and think men are a sport like hunting, if that. Those hips were made for babies, and you will have them." "Will you tell me where I can wait for Rand?" Egwene asked, more faintly than she would have liked. Cerulea was not a dreamwalker, able to interpret dreams, and she certainly had none of the foretelling, but she could be so definite that what she said seemed inevitable. Gawain's babies. Light! How could she have Gawain's babies? In truth, Aes Sedai almost never married. Rare was the man who wanted to marry a woman who, with the power, could handle him like a child if she chose. "This way," Cerulea said. "Is it Sanduin, that strapping true blood I saw around Amys's tent yesterday? That scar makes the rest of his face more handsome." Cerulea continued to come up with names as she led Egwene through the palace, always watching from the corner of a shrewd eye for any reaction. She also did her best to list each man's charms, and since this included describing what he looked like without clothes, Aiel men and women shared the same sweat tents, she certainly got enough blushes. By the time they reached the rooms where Rand would be spending the night, Egwene was more than glad to offer hasty thanks, and firmly shut the sitting-room door on her. Luckily, the wise one must have had business of her own to see to, or she might well have pushed her way in. Drawing a deep breath, Egwene began smoothing her skirts and adjusting her shawl. They did not need it, but she felt as if she had been tumbled downhill. The woman more than liked to play matchmaker. She was capable of fashioning the bridal wreath for a woman, dragging her to lay it at the feet of the man Cerulea had chosen, and twisting his arm until he picked it up. Well, not exactly dragging and arm-twisting, but it came to the same thing. Of course Cerulea would not take it that far with her. The thought made her giggle. After all, Cerulea did not really think she had become Aiel. She knew Egwene was Aes Sedai, or thought she was, anyway. No, of course there was no reason to worry over that. With her hands on the folded gray scarf that held her hair back, she froze at the sound of soft footsteps in the bedchamber. If Rand could leap about from Camelin to Cairhien, perhaps he had leaped straight to his bedchamber, and perhaps someone or something was waiting for him. She embraced Sidar and wove several nasty things ready to use. A Gaishine woman came out, arms full of bundled sheets, and gave a start at the sight of her. Egwene released Sidar and hoped she was not blushing again. Nyella looked enough like Avienda to startle at first glance in that deep-cowled white robe, until you realized you had to add 6 or 7 years to a face that was perhaps not quite so tanned, perhaps a little plumper. Avienda's sister had never been a maiden of the spear. A weaver instead, she had completed well over half her year and a day. Egwene offered no greeting. It would only embarrass Nyella. "Do you expect Rand soon?" she asked. "The Karakarn will come when he comes," Nyella replied, eyes meekly downcast. That truly appeared odd. Avienda's face, even plumper, did not go well with meekness. it is for us to be ready when he comes. Nyala, do you have any idea why Avienda would need to closet herself with Amis and Bear and Milane? It certainly had nothing to do with dreamwalking. Cerulea had as much ability there as Avienda. She is here? No, I know no reason. But Nyala's blue-green eyes narrowed slightly as soon as she spoke. You do know something, Egwene insisted. She might as well take advantage of Guy's shy obedience. Tell me what it is, Nyala. I know that Avienda will stripe me till I cannot sit if the Karakarn finds me standing here with dirty bedding, Nyala said ruefully. Egwene did not know whether Ji'ito was involved somehow, yet when they were together, Avienda held her sister twice as strictly to account as any other Gaishine. Nyala's robe trailed across the patterned carpet as she glided hurriedly toward the door, but Egwene caught her sleeve. When your time is up, will you put off the white? It was not a proper question, and meekness vanished in pride enough for any maiden. To do otherwise mocks Ji'ito, Nyala said stiffly. Abruptly a slight smile flickered on her lips. Besides, my husband would come looking for me, and he would not be pleased. The mild mask returned, her eyes turned down. May I go now? If Avienda is here, I would not meet her. Can I avoid it? And she will come to these chambers. Egwene let her go. She'd had no right to ask, anyway. Speaking of a Gaishine's life before the White or after was shaming. She felt a little ashamed herself, though of course she did not really try to follow Ji'ito, only enough to be polite. Alone, she settled into a severely carved and gilded armchair, finding it strangely uncomfortable after so long sitting cross-legged on cushions or the ground. Tucking her legs beneath her, she wondered what Avienda was discussing with Amis and the other two. Rand, almost certainly. He always concerned the wise ones. They did not care about the wetlander prophecies of the dragon, but they knew the prophecy of Roedion back to front. When he destroyed the Aiel, as that prophecy said he would, a remnant of a remnant would be saved, and they intended to see that the remnant was as large as possible. That was why they made Avienda stay close to him, too close for decency. If she went into the bedchamber, she was sure she would find a pallet made up on the floor for Avienda. Still, Aiel saw such things differently. The wise ones meant Avienda to teach him Aiel ways and customs, to remind him that his blood was Aiel, if not his upbringing. Apparently the wise ones thought that needed every waking hour, and considering what they faced, she could not fault them entirely. Not entirely. Just the same, it was not decent, making a woman sleep in the same room with a man. Still, she could do nothing about Avienda's problem, especially when Avienda did not seem to see the problem. Leaning on her elbow, Egwene tried to think of how she was going to approach Rand. Her mind went round and round, but she had not settled on anything by the time he entered, murmuring something to two Aiel in the hallway before shutting the door. Egwene bounded to her feet. "Rand, you have to help me with the wise ones. They'll listen to you," she burst out before she could stop herself. That was not what she had intended at all. "It is good to see you again, too," he said, smiling. He was carrying that length of Shanchan's spear, carved with dragons since she saw it last. She wished she knew where he had gotten the thing. Anything Shanchan made her skin crawl. "I am well, thank you, Egwene. And you? You look to be yourself again, full of ginger as ever." He looked so tired and hard, hard enough to make that smile appear odd. He seemed harder every time she saw him. "You needn't think you're amusing," she glowered. Best to go on as she had begun. Better than backing and filling, giving him more reason to grin. "Will you help me?" "How?" Making himself at home, well, they were his rooms, he tossed the tasseled spearhead on a small table with leopard-carved legs and shed his sword belt and coat. Somehow he was not sweating any more than the Aiel did. "The wise ones listen to me, but they only hear what they want to. I've come to recognize that flat-eyed look they get when they decide I'm talking nonsense, and instead of embarrassing me by saying so or arguing about it, they'll just ignore it." He pulled one of the gilded chairs around to face her and sprawled in it, booted feet stretched in front of him. He managed to do even that with an air of arrogance. He definitely had too many people bowing to him. "You do talk nonsense sometimes," she muttered. For some reason, having no more time to think, concentrated her thoughts. Adjusting her shawl carefully, she placed herself in front of him. "I know that you would like to hear from Elaine again." Why did his face go all sad like that, and at the same time winter cold? Likely because he had not heard from Elaine in so long. "I doubt Shiriam has been giving the Wise Ones very many messages from her for you." None, so far as she knew, though